Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Sam Smart, and I'm hosting today's program, which is being recorded at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is William Jones, rising senior at Aspen High School. He will interview Tracy Slatcher. Tracy is a professor of particle physics with a concentration in theoretical astrophysics with tenure at MIT. Her research is motivated by questions of fundamental particle physics, in particular, the nature and interactions of dark matter, and she seeks answers to these questions by studying possible signatures of new physics in astrophysical and cosmological data. She was a co-discoverer of the giant gamma ray structures known as the Fermi bubbles erupting from the center of the Milky Way. Take it away, William.
Thank you, Sam. How are you doing today, Tracy?
Yeah, I'm having a great day. Very happy to be here in Aspen, which is beautiful, as opposed to Boston, which is, I think, basically a swamp at the moment.
Yeah. What brings you to Aspen? How did you learn about this program?
So I'm here for a program on searches for new physics beyond the Standard Model, in particular involving leptons, which is a type of fundamental particle. So I'm actually a general member of the center, which means that I'm a volunteer here. I serve on various committees to try to set up the programs here. And part of being a general member is coming to Aspen workshops when you can. So I've been to quite a few over the years. I was here last summer. I'm also here this summer. But the immediate thing that brings me here is this exciting workshop that is bringing together physicists from across the US and the world, thinking about how we might look for physics beyond the Standard Model.
Nice. And how did you originally get into physics? How did you become interested?
So that goes back quite a way. So I think one point that was probably important was when I was about 12, I read Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time. This is, as far as I can tell, a pretty common origin story among theoretical physicists. That book, along with a few others, you know, got many of us excited about physics. In my case, I read the book in part because I read a newspaper article that said that this was like the most purchased book that people bought and then just left on their coffee tables to look intelligent. And I was like, that's terrible. I should read this book. So I read this book. It took me a few weeks, and I just thought it was really exciting that you could use the language of mathematics to describe our universe, including phenomena that seem totally counterintuitive and bizarre, like the existence of black holes, the existence of, you know, time stretching around black holes. And I didn't really know what physics was. I was doing general science courses at the moment, but I knew that I was pretty good at math. And I was like, oh, this is an amazing application for being good at math. So then I got interested, and then I, you know, followed it up through the rest of my schooling and at college.
Yeah. And you attended Harvard University, correct?
For my PhD. Yeah. I did my undergrad degree in Australia. Yeah. I'm originally from Australia, so I mostly did high school in Australia, but I spent 3 years in Fiji as a kid as well. Okay. So, high school, middle school and high school were in Fiji and Australia. And then I did my undergrad degree at the Australian National University, which was my hometown university. And then for my PhD, I applied to a few schools in the US and got in. And so then I came to Harvard for my graduate studies.
And how was the college experience at Harvard like for you?
So of course I was a PhD student, not an undergrad student. So those things are a bit different. But yeah, I had a great time at Harvard. It was, it didn't go exactly the way I had expected, but not in a bad way. So when I first decided to come to Harvard, I was thinking that I would probably work with one of two awesome professors who were there, which is Nima Akani-Hamed and Lisa Randall. They were both doing really interesting work on searches for physics beyond the Standard Model, and they'd both written these really influential papers on the possibility that the universe might have extra dimensions beyond the three space dimensions and one time dimension that we know about. I'd been working on that as well. I'd read their papers a lot. I was like, oh, this is great. So I got to Harvard, and I quickly realized that I needed to take some more classes to get up to speed to this kind of physics. So I spent my first year mostly taking classes. And then at the end of the first year, I went and talked to Nima and was like, Nima, I'd like to do research with you. He was like, sorry, Tracy, I'm moving to Princeton. I was like, oh, okay. So then I went and talked to Lisa and was like, oh, Lisa, you know, I'm interested in doing research with you. And she was like, well, we can give it a go, but it might be a bit difficult because I'm going to be, you know, she'd just written a major book. She was about to go on like a book tour around the world and a sabbatical. She was like, I'm going to be pretty busy, but we can try. And I was like, oh, all right. So the long shot was the, you know, end of this story was that I actually ended up working with Professor Doug Finkbeiner, who was working in astrophysics and on applying astrophysical data to try to study fundamental physics, which was not an area that I had any experience in at the time and not something that I had thought I would be doing when I got to Harvard. But yeah, Doug introduced me to the richness of astrophysical and cosmological data that's out there and all the interesting stuff that you can do with it and the ways that you can use it to test possibilities for new physics. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. So that's what I ended up doing my PhD on. And it was not what I expected coming in. But the nice thing about being somewhere like Harvard was that there were all these, you know, great people doing really interesting research. And so when sort of my plan A didn't work out, there was a plan B that turned out to be fantastic. And I'm very happy with how it went.
Nice, nice. And you now have tenure at MIT, yeah?
That's right.
And how is it like going from a big school like Harvard to a smaller school like MIT?
I mean, at the level of the physics department, MIT doesn't feel like a small school.
Right,
like, MIT
right.
has a huge physics department. I think we have something like 75 full-time faculty, which is a lot.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of advantages to that. So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, sure, if you just add up the number of people there, it's, you know, then I guess MIT is smaller than Harvard, but that's not really how it felt as a student, because the people who I were interacting with were mostly people in the physics or astrophysics groups. But yeah, I mean, they're both great schools.
Yeah. I wanted to learn more about the Fermi bubbles.
Yeah, sure. I was saying to our host before this interview that actually soon after the discovery of the Fermi bubbles, I came and gave a public talk at Aspen High School. So
yeah.
There's a long connection of this work with Aspen. And in fact, some of the follow-up work on the Fermi bubbles, we figured it out while I was here at Aspen for a summer program. So it's a long connection between this discovery and the center here and the town. So the story of the Fermi bubbles is that, let me just tell you a bit of a story, give you a bit of a history, and then I'll tell you what they are.
Okay.
I was a PhD student from 2006 to 2010. In 2009, the situation was that we had seen some experimental results that suggested that there might be something out there in the universe making lots of high-energy particles. And we were excited about the possibility that maybe this was coming from dark matter particles colliding with each other, smashing into each other, and making high-energy particles. And we had, you know, a few bits of data that seemed to point in that direction. I will tell you this part of the punchline first. It turns out the correct answer to this is not that it's dark matter.
Okay.
But that was sort of the direction we were thinking. As always in research, you know, you have a hypothesis, you test it. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
That's the way it goes. This, in this case, was a hypothesis that did not work out. But so we were like, oh, maybe the dark matter particles are colliding, making high energy particles, and that's where these hints of extra high energy emission are coming from. So if this was true, then the high energy particles produced by the dark matter should have been radiating high energy photons, or scattering off ambient photons, particles of light, so scattering the starlight from stars up to really high energies, what we call gamma ray energies. So we're like, well, if we had a telescope that could look for the gamma rays, then we could test directly both whether these high energy particles are out there and whether there seem to be more of them in areas where we've got a lot of dark matter. And we're like, this would be the smoking gun for this possibility. So for that, we needed a gamma ray telescope. And fortunately, we had one, because in 2008 was the launch of the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which has been the flagship instrument for gamma rays in the United States ever since. I mean, it's a US experiment, so I say in the United States, but it's actually up in space,
right,
above us, going around the Earth. It goes around the Earth about every 90 minutes and looks at the whole sky. So Fermi launched in 2008. Their first public data release was in 2009, and we knew exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to try to strip away a model for all the ordinary sources of gamma rays in the sky and then look at what was left. So we did this. We got the data. We actually got the data very early because my advisor had found the website that he thought the data was going to go on and was like refreshing this page frequently, you know, just like waiting for a new episode of a TV show to come out or something. Yeah. It's like refresh. Is it there yet? So when the data first started showing up on this page, we had it immediately. I gave a talk about a week later where I was like, here are initial results from the data. And half the audience was like, wait, the data is out. It's public. We didn't know this yet. So yes, sometimes we were very excited to get these data. So when we looked at the data, when we subtracted off this background model, what we initially saw was this fuzzy glow of gamma rays around the center of our Milky Way galaxy, but extending way above and below the center of the galaxy. Like, so when I say above and below, I mean relative to the disk of the galaxy. Mm-hmm. So our Milky Way is a spiral galaxy. Right. It's like a plate. Right, so we can look towards the center, and if you go to the southern hemisphere and look up in the sky, you'll see this band of stars across the sky that is that plate of mm-hmm. the Milky Way galaxy. So you can look sort of towards the center of the plate, and what we were seeing was that, like, not along the plate but away perpendicular to the plate, there was this like bright glow of gamma rays. And at first we were like, this is amazing, we can declare victory. Because most of the stars in the Milky Way are along that plate, along that disk, along that spiral. And so we thought, what else is there out there far away from that disk except dark matter? We expect the Milky Way disk to be embedded in an invisible cloud of dark matter, which we call the Milky Way's halo. It doesn't have to follow the disk. So we saw all this bright gamma ray emission way away from the disk, and we're like, maybe we've discovered dark matter. This would be amazing. We were wrong about this, but that was sort of the motivation for starting this analysis. So we wrote a paper that was like, there's a giant haze of gamma rays around the Milky Way, and maybe it's from dark matter. But then as more data came in, and we looked at the data a bit more, we started to go, does this actually look like a fuzzy cloud of gamma rays, like you might expect from this fuzzy cloud of dark matter around the Milky Way? Or does it look like something else? And as we got more data and the image sharpened up, we saw that in fact this didn't look just like sort of a featureless cloud of light around the Milky Way. It looked like a figure eight shape, mm-hmm. where the center of the figure eight was the center of the Milky Way galaxy, center of the plate. And we're like, oh, that's really weird. That's not what the distribution of dark matter should look like. So this was the point at which the term Fermi bubbles was coined, because a figure eight shape is sort of like one bubble above the disk of the Milky Way mm-hmm. and one bubble below the disk of the Milky Way. So that they were also sometimes called the Fermi lobes. I think we called them lobes in the first draft of the paper, and then somebody told us that X-ray astronomers meant something different by lobes, and the name was already taken, and we had to change it. And so then they got called the bubbles. So they're bubbles because of their shape. They're Fermi bubbles because they were discovered using data from the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope.
Gotcha.
So then we wrote another paper going, maybe this isn't dark matter. Maybe instead the Milky Way is blowing giant bubbles. And when I say giant, these things are enormous. Mm-hmm. So the distance from us to the center of the Milky Way is about 25,000 light years. There might be an update on that number, but that's roughly right.
Yeah.
If you look at how big these bubbles are on the sky, like, they look like they're 45 degrees high on the sky, which if you do a little bit of trigonometry will tell you that the height of the bubbles above the disk of the Milky Way is also about 25,000 wow. light years. So these things are huge. Just for calibration about how big things look on the sky, the sun or the moon is about 1 degree on the sky. Wow. These are like 50 degrees yeah. on the sky. So they really cover a huge fraction of the sky. So that's what the Fermi bubbles are. And we still don't know exactly where they're coming from. But I think the best hypothesis at the moment is that some millions of years ago, the black hole at the center of our, there's a giant black hole at the center of our galaxy. It shot out these like jets of particles, and they heated up the gas around them, and then the gas expanded outwards. And so you got these sort of like giant bubbles of high energy particles and hot gas sourced by the black hole. But it might not be the black hole. People have also talked about the possibility that maybe a lot of stars exploding in the center of the galaxy could do the same kind of thing. But it does look like it's some kind of, you know, outflow of material coming from the center of our galaxy.
Wow.
Sorry, that was a long answer. I just flooded you with a bunch of information.
No, it's fine.
So,
how was that beneficial to sort of like the understanding of our galaxy?
Yeah, great. Thanks very much for the question. So this question is kind of entangled with what you think the bubbles are mm-hmm. and what caused them. if you think they're coming from the black hole at the center of our galaxy, this tells you about the history of what our black hole has eaten in the past, about how active our black hole has been in the past. It sort of allows you to do galactic archaeology, where you understand what was the black hole gobbling up, right, and, you know, how was it, you know, burping out particles as a result, millions or, you know, maybe millions of years or maybe longer in the past. So I think that's been pretty interesting to people who look at these black holes, both in our galaxy and in other galaxies, because we believe many galaxies in the universe have these large black holes at their centers. And so understanding how they behave and how they interact with their surroundings is, I think, a pretty active area of research. It's quite possible that other galaxies have Fermi bubbles as well, but gamma ray telescopes aren't really very good at resolving structures that are very small or a long way away. So the Milky Way is kind of unique because we're in it, so we can actually see structure, we can actually resolve structures like this, we can see their shape, which you can't do in other galaxies. So in that sense, it's kind of a unique opportunity to study these structures. Now, I mean, if we decided that it's not the black hole, then it would instead be telling us about, like, the history with which stars were formed and exploded in the center of our galaxy. And so then that would be interesting to that community. I guess I'll say the initial discovery prompted a number of follow-ups, some of which used really cool methods to show that there really is, like, gas rapidly moving out of the center of the galaxy up into the Fermi bubble. So again, that just tells us something about how the galaxy evolves, like what its high-energy physics is. What it probably doesn't tell us about is anything about dark matter, unfortunately. Right. But the lesson that I took from that was sort of, if you go looking for difficult to see signals, whether that's from dark matter or something else in these data sets, then you can find things that you never expected. And it's one of the things I really like about working with data, that, you know, nature can always surprise you, that, you know, you learn about things that were not in your original hypothesis. And yeah, so so it's just, you know, in any case, you do a good enough analysis and then you see what you find.
Nice. Well, speaking of dark matter, what's an example of, like, the research you do to find it or research it?
Yeah, sure. I can tell you. So let me first just say a little bit about dark matter.
Yeah.
Because I know I certainly did not study dark matter in high school.
Right.
So the basic puzzle of dark matter is that we've got pretty good evidence that something like 84% of the matter in our universe isn't made up of the particles we know about. You know, mm-hmm. like you learn in school, okay, matter is made up of elements, which are made up of atoms, and atoms are made up of protons and neutrons with electrons orbiting around them. And this works really well to describe about 16% of the matter in the universe. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem to work at all well to describe the other 84% or so of matter in the universe. That 84%, we don't know what it is. We know that it appears to gravitate like matter. So that's why we call it dark matter. Like, right. Matter just means behaves like matter gravitationally. Dark just means, and we don't know.
Right.
Well, where it's actually coming from. People sometimes think that dark matter, you know, refers to, like, a particular hypothesis for exactly what this matter is. But no, when I say the word, I just mean something that appears to behave like matter gravitationally, and we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you know, maybe invisible matter might have been a better word, because we don't believe that this stuff is, like, black. It doesn't absorb light to a good approximation. Light just goes straight through it.
Right.
It's just this, you know, transparent stuff. We believe it's there because we can see its gravitational pull. So that, of course, leaves open this big question of, okay, what is this stuff? And I and many other people try to figure out, you know, how might you figure that out? And there are a lot of ways to do this. There's a giant experimental program trying to see if you can either make dark matter in the lab or identify pre-existing dark matter in the lab interacting with other particles. So they're very active. And also looking for, like we talked about earlier, the possibility that maybe dark matter particles are colliding or decaying out in space,
right,
producing high energy particles. So an example of something, of an aspect of my research that has nothing to do with the Fermi bubbles, is one question you might ask is, okay, suppose dark matter particles could annihilate or decay and make visible particles, how would we know? Like, mm-hmm. how would you look for those visible particles? One consequence, if that was happening, is that basically throughout the whole age of the universe, the whole history of the universe, there would have been this trickle of energy coming from apparently nowhere into the particles that we know about. Really, it's coming from the dark matter, like from the dark matter particles colliding or decaying. But it would have meant that for all the universe's history, there would have been like extra particles just popping into existence, apparently out of nowhere, that could heat up the gas, that could ionize the gas. And so one path of my research was just to ask, what would that look like? If that happened, how would we know? We have really good observations of what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation, or sometimes the afterglow of the Big Bang, which are photons emitted when the universe was only about 300,000 years old, and they've been traveling to our telescopes ever since. So those photons can give us a really good picture of both what the universe looked like when it was very young and all the stuff that has happened to those photons since then. So it turns out that if you add in extra particles, they can heat up and ionize the gas that those photons travel through, and that can modify the spectrum of the photons that you observe in detectable ways. But figuring out like how you get from, okay, I have a model of dark matter, to, and this is what it should look like in those measurements of photons, is a non-trivial job. And so that, you know, one aspect of my research as a theorist has been figuring out how to make those theoretical predictions and tell the experimentalists, this is the kind of signature you should be looking for, this is the hypothesis you should be testing with your data. So that's one example.
Nice. And how has just the scientific community's understanding of dark matter, how has that sort of changed in recent years, if at all?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So let me talk about my own personal time horizon from like when I started working on this stuff around 2007 through now, which is 2024. So that's 17 years. I don't know if that's, I guess that's probably about your lifetime. So over that time period, a lot has changed. So I don't know if this covers the recent criterion that you asked for, but that's going to be, you know, my time horizon, as you know, and middle-aged tenured professor. That is what I'm going to consider recent, basically, since I got into the field. So when I first got into the field, I think there was a strong expectation among particle physicists that maybe dark matter was associated with some kind of new physics at what we call the electroweak scale. So this would mean like some new particle with a mass somewhat comparable to the W boson or the Z boson or the Higgs boson, which are particles we know about. They're each about, you know, roughly 80 to 120 times heavier than the mass of a proton or a neutron. Okay. Now, in 2007, we didn't know what the Higgs boson mass was. We had good reason to think it existed, but we hadn't actually found it yet. I think many people felt that in the course of discovering the Higgs boson, we were also going to find a lot of other new physics around this same electroweak scale. And we had very, you know, plausible looking, very sensible models of the universe where one of those new particles would be the dark matter. So I think there was a strong expectation at that time that we were going to fire up the big collider, the Large Hadron Collider, which turned on in Switzerland around that time, and we were going to find the Higgs boson, and then we were going to find a bunch of other particles, and that was going to tell us what the dark matter was. Now, in retrospect, that was a totally reasonable hypothesis, but the field had maybe gone a little far in thinking, in going from this would be totally reasonable to this just has to be the answer, because it's such a nice explanation. Well, in practice, we turned on the LHC, and thousands of experimentalists did a lot of work, you know, analyzing the complicated data from the LHC, and then, you know, they turned it over to theorists to try to interpret in terms of various models, and the LHC successfully found the Higgs boson, and so far what it's found in the years since is that physics at the electroweak scale seems to be really, really well described by the standard model of particle physics, including the Higgs boson, with very little evidence for anything else at that scale. All right. So like, that's exciting. Yeah. That's not what we were expecting, but it's, you know, it's a really important data point, piece of information. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't have new physics at the weak scale. It'd just have to be hiding from the LHC in some non-trivial way. So that meant that many people in the field started to go, huh, we were wrong about the LHC being about to find a whole bunch of new particles at the weak scale. Maybe this wasn't the right way to look for dark matter. Maybe we should be thinking more broadly. And if you, because there are two questions you could ask, right? One is your question, like, at any given time, what is my favorite idea for what dark matter might be? And I think, you know, in 2006, if you asked the field that, a lot of people in the field would have gone, oh, it's going to be, you know, a 200 GeV new weakly interacting massive particle, bit heavier than the Higgs boson. We're going to find it at the Large Hadron Collider. But you can ask another question as well, which is, what is the space of possibilities that dark matter could possibly be, Mm-hmm. And how can we explore that space? You know, how can we find what the you know, given that we don't know what the answer is, you know, the universe is not obliged to give us our favorite dark matter candidate. How do we explore that space? And so I think that over the last 10 years or so, in particular, people have much more taken that second view, saying like, right, we really don't know what this stuff is. We've got a big puzzle. There are a lot of very plausible possibilities for what dark matter could be. So like, how do we go through them all? How do we try to make sure that we don't miss a totally obvious signal because we don't look in the right place or we don't do the right experiment? And so that's led to like something of a proliferation of smaller experiments where you don't need to spend billions of dollars to build them. You can build them reasonably cheaply. You can do them with a relatively small team. And the goal is to try to make sure that we cover as much of this space of possibilities as we can.
Nice. Last question here, and I don't know if you'll have time to answer it because it's kind of a broad question, but do you think that the scientific community has enough resources to fully understand what dark matter is, or are we ever going to be able to fully understand what it is?
That is a big question, and I don't think that anyone truthfully knows the answer to that question, because it will depend on what dark matter is.
Mm-hmm.
There are very plausible models for what dark matter could be that also solve other problems in the standard model, where if this is the right answer, we could know like a week from now,
right,
or a month from now. The experiments that will prove that are already running. They are testing parameter space that nobody has ever tested before, that it's totally reasonable, totally well motivated. And so, you know, we could be having this interview like in 2 months' time, and I was like, yep, we definitely had enough resources because we did it, right? I mean, that's one possibility. At the other end of the spectrum, there are some scenarios for what dark matter could be that will be really, really hard to find. And at that end of the spectrum is probably not even just like, if you gave us twice as much money, we would be able to find it. It's like, right, there are some possibilities that are just fundamentally really difficult. Like, for example, if you have primordial black holes left over from the very early universe, we've tested them over a wide range of masses, but there's still a gap of a few orders of magnitude. If the answer's in that gap, it's going to be really hard. And then of course in the middle there's this broad range of possibilities where resources do matter.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Tracy from MIT, and our high school intern Will Jones. We hope you enjoyed this Radio Physics. For more information about our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org or follow us on our socials at aspenphysics.